This morning, friends, we continue a brief excursus into the topic of worship. And last week, we talked a little bit about preparation for worship. And today, we're looking at Psalm 95, which deals with, you know, essentially, what are we here for? Why do we come here on Sunday morning? What is it that if we get it done today, it will be a good day. We will have accomplished what we've set out to do by coming here to church on Sunday, and that's worship. Worship God. As we look at Psalm 95, I want to begin with, first of all, just the psalmist's description of worship and try to wrap our heads a little bit around what the psalmist says worship is. Worship is like this, and this is what worship is to be about. If you notice, there's a number of invitations. That word come, this invitation is repeated in verse 1. It's repeated in verse 2. It's repeated in verse 6. Come worship. And you don't have to be a biblical scholar to realize the psalmist is not writing to one person. It's a communal invitation, right? We don't even have to know Hebrew to realize it's not a singular, but it's a plural invitation. Come to worship. Let us sing. Let us come before Him with thanksgiving. Let us bow down. Let us kneel together before God. It's a communal invitation. And in fact, it's not just Psalm 95. And it's not just an invitation to God's people, but this is a missional invitation. It's an invitation to actually all the peoples of the earth. If you notice, not just Psalm 95, but if you have your Bibles open, Psalm 96 says, "Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing to the Lord all the earth." Psalm 97, "The Lord reigns. Let the earth be glad, let distant shores rejoice." Psalm 98, "Sing to the Lord a new song, for He's done marvelous things, and His right holy hand has worked salvation. The Lord has made His salvation known and revealed His righteousness to the nations." Psalm 99, "The Lord reigns, let the nations tremble." So not only is this a communal invitation, it's to others, it's a missional communal invitation. It's an invitation to the whole world to come and worship God. And this makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, in a few hours, we're going to watch football, many of us. And when you do, I doubt very much that any of you are going to hide away in a closet, put on your headphones, and watch the game by yourself. Maybe if you're a Detroit Lions fan, you're used to that kind of thing. I know what that's like. But no, being Seahawks fan, how are we going to do it? We're going to get together with other people. We're going to get together with friends and family and eat lots of food and drink lots of unhealthy beverages, and that'll rot our teeth, and we're just going to have a good time together with other people. And in fact, I will use this as a moment to plug an opportunity. If you're looking for a place for the game, we're going to have the Traeger going at our house and lots of food, so just come on over to our place if you want a communal place to watch the game tonight. It starts at 3:30, so anytime around there, just stop by. Even if you don't want to stay for the whole game, you're like, I can't tolerate Pastor Dan for much longer than a little while. Just stop in, say hi, eat a little food, but we'd love to have you. But that's the way we're hardwired, that we can't even watch a silly football game without doing it communally with other people. Maybe you saw last night on the news, there were like 700 Seahawks fans that climbed Badger Mountain yesterday. And, you know, and they're all wearing their jerseys, and there's just something about you can't celebrate with joy. You can't enjoy football the way it ought to be enjoyed unless you're with people. And how much more when we engage in this activity called worship, when we rejoice, it's best done in community. It's best done with other people. Very clearly, this worship is communal. How else does the writer describe worship? Well, in the first couple of verses, the writer describes worship kind of noisy, big terms, right? We sing for joy. We shout aloud. We come before him with thanksgiving, and we extol God with music and with song. Now, that word extol in verse 2 in the NIV, that's not a word we use very much, right? That's kind of one of those churchy words that we only hear when we're actually in church. And it's interesting because the King James Version uses very common language. Doesn't use that churchy word extol. Does anybody have the King James Version? Could you read verse 2 nice and loud? Make a joyful noise. And we all know what that means, but for some reason the NIV said, no, we want to make it a little more complicated. We have to extol God with music. I don't know why I made that transition choice, but basically the psalmist is repeating himself. Verse 1 is saying, let's shout aloud. Let's make some noise to God. And verse 2, basically saying the same thing. Worship is going to be noisy. And then, notice there's a balance. You drop down to verse 6. Worship is described as bowing down in worship and kneeling before God. Now, that's not a noisy kind of exuberant posture, is it? Bowing down in quietness and humility. In sense of circumspect and thoughtfulness. So whereas verse 1, or not verse 1, but verse 1 and 2, that first stanza is very emotionally charged and it's exuberant, we have the second stanza, the second group of verses, which describe worship very reverent and humble. That may seem kind of contradictory. You have emotionally charged, exuberant worship, and you have reverent humility. But you put these two ideas together, and what do you get? What the psalm writer is saying is, we don't drift into worship. We don't come into worship, you know, preoccupied. Real worship happens, and we're moved to sing with enthusiasm, or we're moved to sometimes deep humility and being circumspect, but never, never does real worship leave us shrugging our shoulders saying, eh, whatever. You know why? It's because when we experience worship, real worship, in a special way, we're in the very presence of God. Look at verse 2. We come before God with thanksgiving. Verse 6, we kneel before the Lord, our Maker. The idea here is we literally come before the face of God. I want you to just hang on to that thought, that in worship we come before the face of God. Because we're going to come back to that in just a moment. But just kind of hang on to that. Worship is coming before the face of God. So I want to move from the psalmist's description of worship. It's communal, it's noisy, and sometimes it's humbling. Move from the description of worship to kind of the impetus. What's the force behind worship? And this is crucial because we hear this often. Let's admit it. Sometimes we've said it ourselves. You've said something like, you know, I can worship God better when I'm hiking in the mountains. Right, you've heard some of this. I don't need church. Nothing is like worshiping God when I'm on the Pacific coast. Just the beauty and the majesty. That's when I'm close to God. And maybe some of you have said stuff. Maybe you've never said it. Maybe you don't want to admit it, but you've thought it. I wish church could be more like hiking up a mountain and seeing Mount Rainier. It's this old, I can get to know the artist through his art kind of idea. I can get to know the artist through the art. There's some truth to that. When you study somebody's art, you can learn much about that artist by studying her art. But you don't really get to know the artist, not personally, not deeply, not intimately. Think of it this way. A young woman really loves Justin Timberlake, okay? And has seen every... Okay, I'm thinking maybe there's a generational disconnect here. Maybe you don't know Justin Timberlake. Think Elvis Presley, okay, so for the older generation, that kind of a person. So you have this young lady, I love Justin Timberlake, I know all of his songs, I know him by heart, I have all of his albums, I have all his CDs, whatever. I've seen every one of Justin Timberlake's movies 15 times. Nobody loves Justin Timberlake like I do. I love him so much, this young lady says, and I'm going to Los Angeles. I'm going to move there, and nobody loves him like I do, and I'm going to find him, and I am going to marry Justin Timberlake. I love him so much. And we know that restraining orders were invented for people like that, right? Right? You don't really know Justin Timberlake. You could watch his movies 100 times, and you don't really know Justin Timberlake. Not intimately, not personally. It takes more to know the artist personally. That's the idea behind what the psalmist describes as the motivation for worship. There's a little word that appears twice in this psalm. It's a tiny little word, but it's so important. It's just 3 letters long. For, F-O-R. In verse 3, let us come to worship God, for He is the great God. He's God above all else. The depths of the sea, the mountain peaks, they're His. He created it all. So why worship? Because God is such a great God. Look at everything He's created. Look at the masterpiece. He's an incredible artist. Look at that. We worship God, for He is a great God. And then look at verse 7. Come, let us worship before God. For He is a good God. He's our shepherd. We've been held in His care. We've been preserved by His mighty hand. He's a good God. Remember, just a couple minutes ago, I said, hang on to that idea of worship is going before the face of God. Worship isn't just seeing the artwork that God has created. Worship is coming into the very presence of God, coming before His face. Now, how does that happen? Well, we're drawn into intimacy with God when He reveals Himself to us. God reveals truth, and that truth moves us. It's another way to think about worship. That worship is being moved by the truth. Look at what moves the psalmist to shout and sing and make music. It's the truth of God. It's His greatness, His power. Students of the Bible used to call it this God's omniscience, that He knows everything, or His omnipotence, that God can do anything. He's a great God. Worship is being moved by that truth. And what moves the psalmist to his knees? What moves him to sprawl out on his face in humility before God? It's His goodness. That when God does flex His muscle, He does so out of love. God heals the brokenhearted. He binds up the hurting. He helps the wounds of the injured. He's our shepherd. He provides for us. He cares for us. He protects us. Those are the truths that move the worshiper in Psalm 95. It's a response to God revealing himself. God makes known the truth about himself. We come face to face with God when he reveals himself. You see, the psalm writer isn't getting all hyped up about the music. Even though, certainly, I mean, we read the accounts, you can imagine. I mean, the psalms talk all about just glorious music and, you know, great instruments. You can imagine. Music had to be pretty outstanding. But the psalmist isn't getting all hyped up about the beauty and the pageantry of the building either, the tabernacle or the temple. Even though when you read the accounts of the tabernacle and the beauty of the temple in the Old Testament, and it's breathtaking, the gold and the ornate detail. But the psalmist isn't getting all keyed up by his friends being there either. He's moved by the truth. As he engages with the revealed truth of God, God being intimate with him and sharing, revealing himself to the psalmist, he can't help but respond in worship. He can't help but respond with exuberant joy. He can't help but respond with deep humility and quietness of soul and reverence. We need truth if we're ever going to have the transforming power of worship. We need revealed truth. Now lastly, we come to the last section in this psalm, and maybe as you heard it read, it seems a little disjointed. All right, the first seven verses of the psalm seem pretty standard, straightforward, positive, joyful descriptions of worship. And then suddenly, verse 8, the writer kind of gets pretty negative, dark. It doesn't seem to fit. Why would the psalm end with the psalmist saying, you remember when you were wandering in the desert, right? And when your ancestors were wandering in the wilderness and they were restless and homeless. You remember the rebellion and how God was so angry with them that generation was lost and those people never entered the rest of God? You remember that? Why would this psalm about praise and worship end on that kind of note? What's going on here? The book of Hebrews actually tells us why. The book of Hebrews actually tells us what's going on. In Hebrews chapters 3 and 4, Psalm 95 is mentioned four times. It's referred to four times in those two chapters. And the writer of Hebrews asks this question. He says, if a generation of Israelites wandered in the wilderness and did not get to enter God's peace, but then the next generation did, they, under Joshua's rule, they did enter the promised land, they did get to enter the peace that was promised. If that's what happened, why, centuries later, would God warn the people in Psalm 95, don't be like them and miss out on God's rest when they're already in the land, when they're in the land of promise, the land of rest? They were still in the promised land. Here's what the writer of Hebrews says. He says, now God says, they shall never enter my rest. Verse 7 of chapter 4, therefore God again set a certain day, calling it today, when a long time later he spoke through David, as it was said before, today if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts. There he is, he's quoting Psalm 95. Now he explains why. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let me try to pull this together. The writer of Hebrews is saying, now why would God in Psalm 95 warn the people of Israel, don't miss out on the rest of God if they already, under Joshua, had entered the promised rest? Well, the answer is because they hadn't. The physical rest that the people of Israel entered into under Joshua's leadership, entering into the promised land, pointed to a spiritual rest that we can still miss out on. But that's also still available. There's a deeper spiritual rest that the physical rest of living in the land of Canaan points to. And what is that? That's the gospel. That's what Hebrews is talking about. Religion says, I obey, I work really hard, I do things right, I'll be accepted. If I do enough, if I'm good enough, then God will bless me. And let's be honest, even if you're not very religious, you're still working very, very hard. You're still working hard to be successful, to be popular, to be admired by your peers. You're still working really hard to be pretty or handsome, thinking that if you just work hard enough, if you just get this thing that I'm after, then I'll be okay. Then I'll know I'm someone. That's work. And the gospel gives us a deep and final rest, because the gospel ends that tiring work. The gospel says that Jesus came to earth and lived the life that we should have lived but didn't. And he died the death that we absolutely deserve to die. But he died that death for us on our behalf. And on that basis, I'm accepted. On the basis of what Christ did on my behalf, Hebrews says I can enter God's rest. On the basis of what Jesus did. So what the psalm is saying, in the last part of the psalm, those last verses, the psalmist is saying, enter into God's rest. Don't miss it. Because if you do, everything I've said so far about worship, you're going to lose it. The psalmist is saying, enter God's rest. Rest in God's goodness. Rest in God's greatness. And how much more do we as Christians know of God's goodness and greatness because of Jesus Christ, born in the flesh, and what he's done on our behalf? But the message is the same. Enter into that rest. Rest in what Jesus has done. Rest in that. Rest in the finished work of Jesus, because if we don't, you know what will happen? Worship will become just one more work. If we are not resting fully in what Jesus has done for us, then worship is going to be just one more thing on that to-do list. And I better get it right. I'm going to come to worship, and I better play the instruments just right. And I better pray just right. I better use the right words. I better use the right level of intensity. And if I get it all just right, then maybe God will bless me. And worship becomes just one more burden weighing us down. And really, no longer will you be worshiping God. No longer will you be worshiping and responding to God's goodness and greatness. Now you'll be worshiping yourself, really. Responding and looking to yourself, your own performance. Not looking to Him. So friends, rest. Rest in the grace of Jesus Christ. and worship like you've never worshiped before.